And welcome to the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Tater. With me is Phil Conan.
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
Phil has a program Wednesdays, Classical Underground, 6 to 8 p.m. And today on the program, we hope to be talking to Bill Wazer. He is a co-author of a wonderful book called Loyal Till Death, Indians in the Northwest Rebellion. Our listeners will know we were speaking of this matter because there is a people hear of the phenomenon called the Riel Rebellion, or they hear of the Northwest Rebellion. And the name that they associate with it, of course, is Louis Riel and the Métis people. But in looking into the government of Canada, the history of relations with the Indigenous people, we came to realize we needed this book. I believe we're joined by Bill Wazer. Are you there, sir?
I'm here.
Let me just make sure our listeners know Bill Wazer, because he's just been won a winner of the 2016 Governor General's Literary Award for Nonfiction. That's 2016.
That's right, last year. Last year's news.
And it's called The World We Have Lost.
Our World We Have Lost.
Our, pardon me. A World.
A World. Yeah.
All right. A World We Have Lost, Saskatchewan before 1905. And I must say that I really realize how much we need your writing on all these matters because this is... for me, at least, somewhat new territory, and it's based on the approach you take. I was going to mention, I better be sure I do this. My mistake. I thought I could easily turn to your... Oh, yes, okay, pardon me. Bill Wazer earned a B.A. in history from Trent University, obtained his M.A. and Ph.D. from the University of Saskatchewan. He worked as Yukon historian for the Canadian Park Service before accepting a teaching position at the University of Saskatchewan in 1984. A full professor since 1990, he specializes in Western and Northern Canadian history and is currently head of the Department of History.
Not anymore. That's an old bio.
Wow. Your book is not that old. You must have just...
I left the U of S in 2014. I'm Distinguished Professor Emeritus today.
Right. I'm going to call your publishers here. This is Fifth House Publishing, but it's
That's
beautiful.
That's right. Oh,
beautiful.
You're reading an old bio on the back of a book from many years ago.
You're looking rather young there.
I'm 17 books in. If you're looking at Loyal Till Death, that was 1997, about 10 books ago.
Yeah, well, I tell you, it could not be more timely.
Yeah.
I have to keep saying this because I'll tell you, I'm sorry for the long introduction, but let me just say that I had a guest not long ago, and we were discussing, of course, the debates about the McDonald statues. And we were discussing his attitude towards Indigenous people, but the Métis. And the famous remark, though all the dogs of Quebec bark, Riel will hang.
Yeah.
And so my guest said yes, and you know it was terrible, and showed his attitude towards Francophones, I guess, and the Métis. But then he remarked, and then he was hanged, and eight others. And I said, eight others. Who were they? And so I sought out to find who the eight were and why. We talk about Riel. We focus so much on Riel.
Right, well, you do.
And the Métis. And your book, thank you, answers my question. And I'll tell you where it leads. I discovered a mass grave. They'd been hanged all together, eight Cree and Assiniboine.
There are actually six Cree, two Assiniboine.
Yeah, Assiniboine. Altogether eight, and some people speculate nine. But at any rate.
No, there weren't nine.
Yeah. Well, you're the man who knows. So there was a mass grave without a marker. Then somebody noticed that the bones were appearing, and so then they decided, okay, well, let's put a slab of concrete, but
That's
still
right.
no marker.
That's right.
And I set out to get an explanation and even hopefully get a marker. But then I learned that they have the names there.
They actually have a grave plate now with the eight names, and they have teepee pulls over that site, yes.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that it needs what we need is your book to tell us why this ugly neglect happened. And I'm not speaking to whether or not somebody committed a crime,
yep.
but that eight men could be tried and had no defense to speak of, and that then they are hanged together, put in a mass grave, and we learn that we speak of the Riel Rebellion, and we don't. No one explains why they were hanged.
Yeah.
And your book, let's get right to it. What's been absent is the Indian or Native account of the events themselves that led to to this mass grave. And as I understand your book, you say it is because, frankly, no one asked or respected Indian opinion.
Well, in part, what Loyal to Death attempts to do is tell the story of the 1885 Northwest Rebellion from the First Nations, or as they were called at the time, the Indian point of view. And it was the first book to do so in 1997. So as you said, Phil, most people talk about Métis and Louis Riel, Canadian government, Northwest Field Force, and the First Nations people are seen to be secondary peoples on the sidelines. And I'm not saying, and neither does my co-author Blair Stone, Child of Cree from a community in southern Saskatchewan. We're not arguing that Indians were full and equal participants in the rebellion. We argue that any Indian involvement was isolated, sporadic, and limited. But despite that, despite this limited involvement, the government of the day in 1885 decided to use the apparent Indian involvement in the 1885 Northwest Rebellion to deal with Indian peoples and their persistence in trying to get the federal government to uphold treaty promises. This is what's happening through 1884, and the federal government is continually being nagged by Cree leaders. You're not living up to your treaty obligations. And after the Northwest Rebellion, John MacDonald, Edgar Dewdney, and other senior Indian affairs people see this as an opportune time to subjugate the Cree.
Yeah, it's. I'm reading it, I was reminded of somebody in American politics recently or some years back said, "Don't let a crisis go to waste."
That's right. Yeah, and that's exactly what the MacDonald government decides to do. So after the rebellion in 1885, you have the introduction of the pass system, which prevents or forbids First Nations people from leaving their reserve or their home community without the permission of the Indian agent. You've got a number of reserves, bands declared disloyal, and because they're considered disloyal, the federal government stops their treaty payments, which is a violation of the treaty agreement, but they withhold treaty payments. And in fact, there's a document put forward by Hayter Reed, who was the assistant Indian Commissioner for the Northwest Territories. It's got a rather mundane title called The Future Management of Indians, but it's far from management. It's total and complete subjugation after 1885.
Yeah, I read, in your account, you have, it's very vivid. They say take their horses, take their wagons.
Yeah.
And really, it was a brutal response.
It was, and it wasn't supposed to be that way, Phil. When you go back to 1876, and I'm in Treaty 6 territory, I'm in Saskatoon, and I'm south of Fort Carleton, where that treaty was negotiated in August of 1876. The Treaty Commissioner, Alexander Morris, at the time, the Crown's representative, spoke about the treaty as a long-term reciprocal relationship. That's not me. Mm-hmm. That's not Mr. Wasses or Taka Cooper there at the time. That's what the Treaty Commissioner said. And he also put the treaty in terms of family or kinship. And he talked about how the Great Queen Mother would look after mm-hmm. Indian peoples as they made the difficult transition to farming. And so that was what was said in 1876. That's the same year, though, ironically, that the Indian Act is passed, 1876, which more or less makes Indians wards of the state. So you've got a treaty commissioner doing one thing, and yet you've got the federal government doing another thing. And quite frankly, the federal government more or less regarded Treaty 6 as a one-time real estate transaction and not the beginning of a long-term reciprocal relationship.
To borrow a phrase, it seems on the white side, the European side, they speak with forked tongue. I mean, this is amazing.
Well, I don't...
Revelation of the way it's done, the way they did it.
Yeah, and they, well, quite frankly, the government by the end of 1870s didn't realize that it was going to take not only commitment, but funding to do the kinds of things that need to be done to help make Indian peoples make that transition because of the disappearance of the bison. They were promised help, they expected help, and the federal government at the time, late 1870s, early 1880s, Canada enters a recession, it wants to cut back, and people in Ottawa saw Indians as deadbeats, standing in the way of progress. And everybody slams John Macdonald for what he does or what he doesn't do, but what's not also understood is that the Liberal opposition was even more demanding in terms of cutbacks and that we shouldn't be helping Indian peoples during that period. They were constantly criticizing Macdonald, ironically, for going too far or doing too much.
We're speaking to Bill Wazer, and by the way, his latest book won the Governor General's Literary Award for Nonfiction, A World We Have Lost, Saskatchewan before 1905. It's part of this, I believe it's my understanding for your book is that, of course, the leaders, people like Poundmaker and Big Bear, and their predecessors as chiefs, thought they were dealing, the concept was we're dealing with equals and that you're holding out the hand of brotherhood.
That's right.
That wasn't the understanding on the other side.
No, and in fact, a lot of people say that Indian leaders were duped, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what needs to be appreciated is that Indians have been negotiating treaties for decades with the Hudson's Bay Company. Before they traded with the Hudson's Bay Company, they had a pre-trading ceremony where there was the smoking of the pipe, the exchange of gifts, and the talk of terms of trade, et cetera, et cetera. So they were used to treaties. That was an economic treaty.
Mm-hmm.
But to show you the seriousness of what happened at Carleton in 1876, two leading Cree chiefs at the time were Mr. Wasses and Attakakoop, their Cree leaders. They show up with their own translator. They want to ensure that what is discussed at that treaty meeting is accurately translated into Cree. And so that, you know, I always bring that example up to underscore how serious they were about it.
Yes.
And unfortunately.
And he was the best in the room, wasn't he?
Yes, that's right. Peter Erasmus, who was a Métis, who actually helped with the Palliser expedition in Western Canada in the 1850s. But these Cree leaders were pushing the federal government to uphold treaty promises, and in Loyalty to Death, we argue that the government, as you said in earlier comment, a crisis is something that should be taken advantage of, and that's what the Macdonald government does. So at the beginning of the program, you talked about the hanging of the eight at Battleford.
Mm-hmm.
That's the public part of the federal government campaign against Indian peoples. There were over 50 people brought to trial for crimes, no matter how circumstantial or whatever, and prosecuted and sent to Stony Mountain Penitentiary, including three chiefs for treason felony. There were the eight warriors in the largest mass execution in post-1867 history at Battleford. That's the public part of the campaign because the government wants to send out the message that we are determined to ensure a peaceful, orderly West. And then there's the private part of the campaign, this management of Indian peoples, which happens after 1885.
Mm-hmm.
One of my colleagues says that Canadians developed a great amnesia about what had happened during that period. And quite frankly, it's not that widely known. And I appreciate what you said at the beginning. We're making taking steps in Western Canada to do something about this in terms of educating non-Indigenous students. The Office of the Treaty Commissioner in Saskatchewan has had a concerted campaign over the last decade. It's called We Are All Treaty People, and to emphasize the idea that it is a cooperative relationship that involves both sides.
Yeah. By the way, did you say there? They now have, I've seen a picture of the graves of the eight.
Yeah.
And I see their names. By the way, again, when I was looking into this, various historians didn't even have the names straight.
Right.
There was not even an agreement of who they were.
That's right.
And yet the record was there. They had run them up in front of a judge and condemned. Is there a marker saying who they were or what?
Yes, their names are on the gravestone.
But is there like a text telling you what you're looking at?
No, there isn't, and that's what we need to do.
Please do that.
what they are starting to do now, though, Phil, is that if you go to the Northwest Rebellion sites, they were plaqued by the Historic Sites and Monuments Board in the 1920s and 1930s. They have introduced new signage at those sites, so it shows the different interpretations, different historical, history is about change over time. And if it wasn't for new sources, new approaches, new ways of doing things, I wouldn't be in this business. So there are new plaque texts there that provide further information, a more detailed explanation for what was happened, because those old texts present a very one-sided, narrow explanation of the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, again, I'm impressed, as I know you are, from the writing. These leaders were very sophisticated, and for example, knowing to get their own translator.
Yep.
I bet they'd been around that block a few times.
Yes.
And realized we better get her. And the way, even for crying out loud, even in the when they faced death or imprisonment, the Big Bear was very eloquent.
That's right.
And a pound maker. And nobody, if people had listened, and I guess they didn't want to listen because it would have cost them all that land they want to take. I don't know what it was. But these were easily leaders you could work with and accomplish things.
That's right. And for the sake of your listeners, that your Big Bear, Pound Maker, and One Arrow, they're Cree chiefs from 1885. They were charged with treason felony. And the federal government wanted to make an example of these Cree chiefs and send a message that you step out of line, not only will your leaders be imprisoned, but you will be punished. And so you're quite right. At their trials, it's quite evident that they did all they could to prevent bloodshed. They tried to hold back warriors, and they did. Poundmaker did certainly at the Battle of Cut Knife Hill when the Cree camp was attacked there. And they're very eloquent. In fact, when Poundmaker comes in to surrender to General Middleton on May 26, 1885 at Fort Battleford, he's accused of being a rebel, and he says, we made war gently. My people made war gently. Now, unpack that, and he's more or less saying, if we wanted to have gone to war, we would have gone to war, but we didn't. We made war gently. And the other interesting thing at that meeting is that you've got Middleton sitting in a chair, very imperious, and the Poundmaker and his headmen before him on the ground. At one point, Poundmaker says, well, one of the women want to address you about what happened during the rebellion and what it meant for women and children. And Middleton scoffs at that. How dare you want to have a woman talk at our war council? And then Poundmaker replies, well, I thought Queen Victoria presided at yours. And when that's translated from Cree in English, it sends ripples of laughter all through the troops.
Yes. I'm so struck by that even at at the trial, Big Bear managed to get a laugh out of people he made a reference to the way people looked in the room. He was a very human.
That's right.
And very intuitive. I mean, he understood the seriousness of the situation.
Yes.
But he was showing that he comprehended, and he wanted people to maybe look in a mirror the way they were talking to him. and about him. Let's clarify that. The your book does an excellent job. The Poundmaker, well, let me say Big Bear, more stressed in the book, said they, in 1884, in the fall, I believe, let's make a united front of all of us.
That's right.
Because we've all been cheated. We're all getting run around. And by the way, the Great Hunger, we got to emphasize the Great Hunger existed for
That's
everybody.
Right.
And they needed food badly. And he suggested a united front and a peaceful approach.
That's right.
Nonviolent.
And in fact, if you can, Phil, we can back that up to 1876. In 1876, the second meeting for Treaty 6 is held at Fort Pitt. The first one's at Carlton in August. Then they move on to Fort Pitt in September of 1876. Big Bear at that treaty meeting says to the treaty commissioner, what he fears most is the rope around his neck. Hmm. Now, that is Peter Erasmus is no longer there, and it's poorly translated. And the treaty commissioner thinks that Big Bear is afraid of being hanged. And the treaty commissioner says, why would an Indian be worried about being hanged? He must be a bad Indian. When, in fact, the metaphor that Big Bear was using is that he feared losing his independence.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he was afraid of. And in 1876, Big Bear stayed out of treaty. He refused to take treaty for two reasons. He wanted to see whether the government would keep its word, and he also believed what was being offered was not enough. So in 1876, he stayed out, and he's not forced to enter treaty until 1882, as you say, the Great Hunger. He's forced into treaty in 1882 for the sake of his people, but by 1884, he is leading a concerted effort to not only bring together Cree bands, but the reaching out to their traditional enemies, the Blackfoot and Alberta, and saying to them, you know, they're just as aggrieved and disillusioned. Let us work together peacefully to force the Canadian government to live up to its treaty promises.
Mm-hmm. And that was now at this point, Riel has come on the scene.
That's right.
But he's not among them. These
no.
meetings that Big Bear is organizing are really for those nations that have these treaties or are thinking of joining. He did not invite. He didn't invite Riel to lead the meeting or say what they're going
right.
to do or make a common cause.
This is what we argue in Loyal Till Death, is that everybody thinks that once Riel arrives on the scene that he takes over and he speaks for both Métis and Indian peoples. That's not true. You've got to realize in 1884, the Indian peoples had their own leaders, they had their own strategy, and they had their own way of getting there peacefully. So you've got two, actually there's a third resistance. So there's the Métis resistance of 1885,
mm-hmm.
there's the Indian resistance trying to get the government to uphold its treaties. And what a lot of people forget about is that the whites were aggrieved too. Newcomers came to Western Canada in the 1870s and 1880s, and they're thoroughly disillusioned with the situation in Western Canada. They do not have adequate political representation, bringing the virgin prairies under cultivation is not easy. There's years of trial and error. And the railway that is supposed to go through Prince Albert, Balfour, and Edmonton in 1881 actually goes through Regina, which didn't exist at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're very frustrated, too. So there is a lot of angst in Western Canada, 1884, 1885.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by that, too, in your book. You show that so many of these, of the people, I guess, who would call the settlers, the whites, actually had very cordial, I guess I would say, relations. They were trusting.
Yep.
That when they had the issue of the hostages, most of these, they were not in fear of their lives.
No.
And I seem to recall some details, for example, when the hostages happened at Frog Lake and elsewhere, that there were still families going back and forth talking to them.
Yes.
As though, you know, there wasn't as though, oh, my goodness, go over there, they're crazy, they're going to take you. No.
If you look at the census for the mid-1880s in Western Canada, 4 out of 5 formal marriages were mixed marriages.
Four out of five,
80% were mixed marriages in the mid-1880s. And I argue in my other book, A World We Have Lost, is that 1885 is a watershed period, because after 1885, Indians are confined to the reserves through the pass system. If you're a Métis person, you want to hide your identity because you're associated with the rebellion. And after 1885, Western Canada is to be an Anglo-Canadian West, where the best features of British civilization are to take root and flourish. So there's no place after 1885 for Indigenous people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, they were very aggressive about conversion. I see the where there could be a book talking about the role of the churches, and because some of it is so embarrassing.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, the eight, it's clear they were coming around trying to convert them. A couple of them did agree to be converted, took I would call them Anglo names, church names.
That's right.
But they were understanding that this is the only way you're going to live here.
Yeah. The same thing happened to One Arrow. One Arrow was a traditional Cree chief, charged with treason felony. He's released early because he's ill. He's so ill in the spring of 1886 that he can't go back to his home community. And instead, he's sent to St. Boniface and the bishop's residence. And just days before he dies, he's finally baptized and named Mark, something he has staunchly resisted for decades. But he's on his deathbed, and that's when he is converted.
Well, I am so glad that you told us about all these things, particularly it comes down to Miserable Man, how God must have named him. And he, I think, wasn't he the one who continued to chant and and also said some unflattering things about the treaties?
Yeah.
And that was, those were his last words.
That's right.
Just on this last point, on this matter of Riel, in 85, it looked to me like the Métis phenomena, and they had their grievances, but they were separate. They resembled those of the Cree and others, but it ended up being folded in, for the cause of Big Bear and Poundmaker. It was like a sideswipe to what they were trying to do, because
that's right.
They did tell him they didn't agree with the rebellion.
That's right, very much so. And in fact, Big Bear and other Cree chiefs knew that if they went down the road to violence, it would be the end of their. Of their treaty rights movement. They knew that it would derail it, and so that's why they did all they could to stay away from it.
And they made the effort. But you know, again, your book is so helpful because these are complex societies. There are young warriors. There are people who are just plain hungry and are tired of listening to promises, even from the chiefs. And so if one of them picks up a gun or runs off to the camp of Riel, that falls on the head of Big Bear or Poundmaker
or
the others.
And I'm not saying there was not Indian violence. That's why those eight were executed, because they had committed murders. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're isolated events. It's sporadic. It's limited. It's not part of some grand campaign, some grand alliance.
Yeah, and by the way, MacDonald wanted that to be the case. He said he wanted them hanged, right?
Yes. He said the executions ought to convince the red man that the white man governs.
So
I've actually written a piece for the Osgoode Hall Society called The White Man Governs, and it looks at the Indian trials from 1885.
Yeah. Well, it certainly, the concept was always to be reminding them of who was boss. And you have a phrase here. I thought, boy, that was an unfortunate choice of words. One of the maybe more responsible white leaders was speaking to the chiefs, and he says, "We will teach you the cunning of the white man."
Yep.
Well, that turned out to be truer than everybody realized. At any rate, it was, we should add last, so many details, wonderful details in your book. But the famine, here they were in a situation of famine, and there was a famine clause.
In the treaty.
But the white administrators were into educating, so they said, no, you have to work.
That's right.
To get rations.
Work for rations. They did not want to simply feed them. And, Phil, this is not uncommon. If you look what happened in the 1880s with First Nations people and the idea of working for rations, jump forward 50 years into the 1930s. And the argument in the 1930s, we have to be careful with dispensing relief. It can be a drug. People could become addicted to it. Yes. And so that's why you had people doing boondoggling, make work projects in the 1930s before they could get the relief assistance. So the thinking's the same. It hasn't changed. It's just the group is different.
Freud calls that projection, right? You describe a number of white people who are administering who were actually there because they were related to McDonald.
That's right, yeah.
Or had other friends.
Other political connections.
And people who were supposed to be teaching farming who couldn't teach.
That's right.
But were being paid.
Yes.
And then when anything went wrong, all they had to do was disparage the Indians.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful book. I want everybody to know, again, the title, I realize it's one of your many books, but it's my favorite book so far, Bill.
Thank you.
Loyal Till Death, Indians and the Northwest Rebellion, and that's Stonechild and Wazer. And Bill Wazer has just won in 2016, winner of the Governor General's Literary Award for Nonfiction, A World We Have Lost, Saskatchewan, before 1905. If there's going to be some things done, and are you involved with the monument business? They need to get this text.
I'm not involved in the monument business. I'm working on a new project on Almighty Voice, who was the most wanted man in Canada in 1895, and he was a Willow Cree man from just north of Saskatoon. So I'm into that project.
Yeah. Well, if it's a good book, they'll probably make a monument.
Okay.
Bill Wazer, it's really a pleasure talking to you, and congratulations on this book, yourself and Mr. Stonechild.
Thank you.
Canada needs a book. So thanks a lot, and
thank
we look
you.
Forward to maybe talking to you again soon.
Okay, thank you. Was a pleasure.
Bye-bye. That was Bill Wazer, and it is a wonderful book. Loyal Till Death, Indians in the Northwest Rebellion. And the quote at the beginning of the book is John A., who, if you haven't seen John A., he's at Queen's Park and looking down on us. And the quote is, "The executions of the Indians ought to convince the red man that the white man governs." That was said on 20 November 1885. And before we go to break, I want to read you the names just so you'll know them, because I'm tired of this idea that we say 8 indigenous people were hanged. They were their names were Round the Sky, Bad Arrow, Miserable Man, Itka was, by the way, was Assiniboine, Man Without Blood, Moosinas, Moosinas is not executed, Iron Body, and Little Bear, and of course the best known of the group, his name gets mentioned more, is Wandering Spirit. And actually, when you read what happened at Frog Lake, you just say this is a terrible tragedy growing out of state policy. And, of course, it was completely heinous that they not get a trial. They had no defense. And then they put them all on a scaffold together and at one moment hanged them all and put them in a mass grave. I just remind everybody that happened. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. We will take a break, and we will come back, and Phil and I will go over some matters.